He thought of the piece of a candy bar in his car, a survival ration if he got stuck. He was half tempted to go get it, but if he did, it might not be there for Jennifer when she needed it.
"Maybe she'll get lucky," Washington said. "Maybe some guy farther down the road will take her in."
God save us if we are really at this point already.
"Sir, I saw it in Nam. Hell, 19-year-old GIs thought it was heaven. A piece for a couple of bucks? But you looked at those girls, and I tell you, Southern Asian girls are some of the most beautiful in the world, and it made you sick. 15-year-old kids that should have been in school, out selling their tail to feed their parents and kid sisters and brothers.
And now it's come to America." Washington shook his head.
"Damn all war," he sighed.
"You wanted me down here for something?"
"Some bad rumors starting to come in this morning. I think Charlie needs to know. I'm going to head back into town shortly to tell him."
"What is it?"
"Refugees are talking about something called the Posse, taking over the interstate. They're down in the Charlotte area. Some said they're moving up Interstate 77 towards Statesville.
Have a lot of vehicles that run."
"The Posse? Hell, it sounds like the Wild West."
"No, it's worse. The Posse was a name for a pre-war gang with branches all over the country. Punks, gangbangers, who would pop a bullet into someone's head as a joke before this even started. Drug dealers, the scum of the earth, long before we ever got here. And the ones most ruthless to survive now that our worst nightmares have become real."
John realized just how really isolated their small town was. Several years back, the Asheville paper had run a couple of articles about gang activity starting to flare up, but the local police had put it down fast.
"The Posse. One poor woman we led through with the last bunch said she was held prisoner by them for several days and escaped. Don't even want to talk about what they did to her. But it was beyond sick. Everyone's talking about it on the other side of the barrier. Sort of like an urban legend, running with the refugee bands on the road. Some say 1,000 or more, and well armed. They're moving like ancient barbarians out there."
"Damn," John sighed. And yet again, movie images, the Road Warrior films, and all the cheap imitations of the genre back in the 1980s and early 1990s.
"I think we better start getting more vigilant. Just a gut feeling, if this is real, they'll finally head our way. They'll figure Asheville, up in the mountains, must be loaded with food, and may be a good place for them to take over and hole up. They'll follow the trail of refugees and wind up here," Washington said.
"I heard a radio broadcast," John said.
"You mean Voice of America?" Washington replied.
"How did you know?"
"I was sitting up here last night, keeping an eye on things. The radio in that beautiful Mustang still works. Damn, I just turned it on. Sitting in an old Mustang, it was almost flashback time. Half expected to hear Wolfman Jack or Cousin Brucey."
John chuckled.
"Yeah. And loud and clear, had the signal for about an hour or so. Just wish they'd knock off the patriotic stuff, play some old R&B or rock. Yeah, I heard it."
"What do you think?"
"It's propaganda for morale, nothing more. Maybe the news about the coastal towns is on the mark, but for the rest of us, today, next week, it's bullshit. We got to look out for ourselves."
"I'm passing word at the barrier for people to turn around, to start heading for the coast. I know that's insane. None have the strength to make it now, but maybe it will be a counter-rumor that will work back down the line."
John nodded. "Downside, though," John said, "if the rumor hits that Posse crowd, that will move them up our way even faster. Under martial law, every one of those bastards will be shot. The last thing they want now is any authority anywhere. We better work out a good tactical plan to defend this place against a serious attack right now and stop thinking about mob control or a few desperados trying to sneak in. If they have any ex-military types at all with them, they'll do a probe first, then hit us hard. We gotta keep an eye on our back doors, the railroad tunnel, and the old back roads down to Old Fort. We're no longer dealing with refugees. We'll be facing an army as ruthless as anything in history.
Washington nodded in agreement.
I think I'll go home, John said. The two shook hands, and John went back up the slope by the bridge. He nodded to Brett, concealed in the grass.
Fran got a bit jumpy there. Glad she didn't shoot that woman.
Same here.
Though John wondered if a bullet in her head might have been an act of mercy. He got in the Edsel and headed for home. As he pulled into the drive, the two fools, Ginger and Zack, came off the deck to greet him. He knelt down to pet both and found himself hugging them.
Daddy!
It was Jennifer, Pat with her.
Everything okay?
Sure, Daddy.
He looked at Jennifer closely. She had lost a few pounds. At every meal, Jen had been pushing as much food into her as possible, meat and vegetables, which right now were still boiled dandelions. He looked up at the orchard. If only the trees were peach trees. In another several weeks, they could start to gather the peaches. The apples were growing, but far too slow, it seemed. He had never had any real interest in the 8 trees, other than their beauty in the spring. The apples were rather sour in the fall, and they usually just left the fruit there to drop, delighted when the apples lured in bears to feed on them.
"She had to eat a little chocolate earlier," Pat said. "Blood sugar went down."
"Snitch!"
Jennifer snapped.
"I promised your dad I'd keep an eye on you. I can take care of myself."
He hugged both of them, the two arguing as he went into the house. Jen was half asleep, book laid across her chest, an old book on the Civil War.
"Where's Elizabeth?"
"Oh, she and Ben went out for a walk,"
Jen said, and sat up, rubbing her eyes. "They're out there walking a lot these days," John said.
"Well, son-in-law, you better sit down."
"Why?"
"I think you need to talk to the two of them."
"About what?"
"Sex? Getting pregnant?"
"Aw, damn, Jen, not now, not today. I don't even want to think about it in relationship to her."
"Few fathers do. But frankly, my son-in-law, I think your 16-year-old daughter is now, how shall we say, a woman."
"Jesus, don't even talk to me about this now."
"Tyler and I had you and Mary figured out rather quickly."
He blushed. Jen had never said that before, and he looked over at her.
"Almost to the day, I bet. At least I did. Tyler, like any dad, went totally blind to reality. And, John, I see it in your daughter now."
"Jen, not now," he sighed. "There's so damn much else going on."
Jen nodded slowly.
"And you don't want to face this issue."
"Okay, but you better face up to it, John. Those two are scared. Don't see much of a future ahead. The old restraints fall away. I'm old enough to remember the Second World War. It was the same then. 18-year-old kids who knew each other just a couple days or weeks would figure what the hell, and either marry on the spot or have to get married within a few months. Our Greatest Generation stuff tends to make us forget just how young and scared they were back then.
So face up to the reality, dear son-in-law. You're the history professor. You know what happens inside kids when there's a war on."
Too much was happening today. He stood up, peeked into Jennifer's room. She and Pat were playing a game with Jennifer's Pokemon cards. Her skin color looked off, a bit yellowish, pale.
Dear God, but one plane load of supplies into Asheville, but one, and my worst worry is gone.
"Would you talk to her?"
he asked, looking back at Jen.
"Coward. And yes, I already have. But I think you, as a dad, better talk to both of them as well."
"Okay, later," he said, a bit too quickly.
Looking at Zack and Ginger, John went to the gun cabinet. He pulled out the 20-gauge and headed out the door, the two dogs slowly trotting along behind him, knowing that today there just might be some food if their master and provider got lucky.
Chapter 9 Day 63
He awoke to the dogs barking, and instantly knew someone was in the house. They had drilled the plan after the murder of the Connors last week, their home at the top of the road, all four of them, parents, two kids, the house then ransacked from one end to the other for whatever scraps of food they might have. He didn't hesitate, shotgun up as he stepped out of the office, crouching low. The two dogs were barking madly, snarling, and then he heard the crack of a gun and a high-pitched yelping scream. He stepped into the living room. The back door into the kitchen was wide open. Two men. At least it looked like two men. So this was the moment. And he did it without hesitation. The first blast nearly decapitated the man by the door. The second turned. One shot fired wild, and the second blast caught that one in the guts, flinging him back against the kitchen counter. The girls had been drilled. If there was an intruder, they were supposed to get on the floor behind the bed. The waterbed where they now slept together was an excellent barrier. After several seconds, Elizabeth started screaming, "Daddy!
Stay put!"
Crouched down low, he came around the turn into the kitchen. The one man was definitely dead. Even in the dark moonlight, John could see that. The other whimpering, kicking spasmodically. By his side was Zack, crying pitifully, Ginger with hackles raised, snarling at the wounded man. There could be someone outside, John realized. But first he crawled over to the wounded man, grabbed his pistol, which was on the floor, a .22 revolver from the feel of it, and stuck it into his belt. The other man didn't have a gun, just a machete, and John took that with his free hand. He headed back to the wide-open door, was about to step out, then thought twice, doubling back through the house, coming in low to first Jennifer's room and then Elizabeth's, to make sure there wasn't a third intruder. Past his old bedroom, he looked in for a second.
"I'm all right. Now don't move," he hissed. "Elizabeth, you have your gun."
"Yes, Daddy,"
and her voice was trembling. "If I come back to this room, I'll call out first. If anyone else comes through, you shoot and don't hesitate."
"Yes, Daddy."
Back out through his office, and then the front door, which he slipped open, circling back around the house. No one else. He slipped through the rear door into the kitchen and touched the basement door. It was still locked. Then once more, down low, sweeping Jennifer's and Elizabeth's rooms yet again, nervously popping the closet doors open, both rooms still empty. He went back into the kitchen.
"Jen, light a candle and get out here."
A minute later, the flickering light illuminated the kitchen. Jen recoiled at the sight of the first man, face gone. The second was crying louder now, curled up. And then there was Zack. John went over to his old buddy, his friend of so many years, who had saved their lives with his warning. He was shot in the top of the back, just behind the shoulder blades.
"Oh, God, Zack," John sighed.
And like so many dogs, so desperately hurt, Zack licked John's hand, as if by doing so he'd feel better. John looked over at Jen, wide-eyed.
"You got to help me,"
it was the wounded man.
"Please help me."
John actually felt stunned with how quickly he reacted. The Glock he kept strapped to his side even when he slept was out, round already chambered.
"John?"
It was Jen. He squeezed the trigger. The discharge of the 9mm round, an explosion that set Elizabeth and Jennifer to screaming again.
"It's all right," John shouted. "It's all right, girls, but stay put."
John looked at Jen, who'd stood stock still, horrified. "I'd have shot him in town if he'd lived that long." John had executed 5 in the last week, 2 of them locals who had stolen a pig, killed it, and were gorging themselves up in a mountain hollow when finally tracked down, the 2 pathetic fools never fully realizing that hungry men could now smell meat cooking from half a mile away. The other 3 caught raiding a house just like the 2 on the floor now.
"Jen, you'll have to help me drag them outside. I don't want the girls to see this mess."
Zack's whimpers made John turn around. Ginger was lying by Zack's side, licking her old friend. John filled up. The execution-style killing had bothered him not in the least. Washington Parker was right. After the first one, it starts to get easier, and in this case the men invading his home threatening his girls, it didn't bother John in the slightest. It was Zack, though. Zack and Ginger were down to skin and bones, ribs showing through their once sleek coats. Regardless of the ban on letting dogs run wild, John had let them out to forage, since their old stomping grounds had been up in the woods that became Pisgah National Forest, not 100 yards away. Though he worried that others out hunting would bag them, so far they had been lucky. He knelt down by Zack's side. Zack lifted his head and again licked John. "Thank you, old friend," John sighed. "Thank you for everything."
"Do you want me to do it?"
Jen whispered. Startled, he looked up at her. "No, he was our dog. Mary's and mine." He pulled out the .22 taken from the dead man, cocked it, and put it behind Zack's ear. Ginger stood up, sensing something, whimpering loudly now. And John couldn't do it, dissolving into tears.
"I'll take care of him," Jen whispered. "You go outside. Take Ginger with you. You don't want her to see it either. Now go on."
Jen left the room and was back seconds later with the last pack of cigarettes and the bottle of scotch that held a final precious ounce.
"Girls, we're safe, but you are to stay in your room on the floor," Jen shouted.
John looked at Zack and felt at that moment like a coward, completely unmanned. He knelt down and kissed Zack on the forehead. He was bloody, panting hard. He stood back up and then went outside, dragging Ginger by the collar, and let her loose. He lit the cigarette and uncorked the bottle.
"There, there, Zack," he could hear Jen in the kitchen. "Tell Tyler I love him. You remember our dog Lady? It's time to play with her now."
The muffled crack of the pistol had John leaning over the deck railing, crying, Ginger whimpering and nuzzling against his legs. There was such a surreal sense of disconnect. "I just killed two men, executing one without a second's hesitation. But this? Sobbing over a dog?" Jen came out the door a moment later, bearing Zack, wrapped in a blanket.
"He's so light," she said softly. "He's better off now."
"I'll bury him once it gets light," John said.
"No, John."
"What?" And then he realized. No, not Zack. No, he couldn't. "I'd vomit. The girls, too, we can't."
"Take him down to the Robinsons. It won't be the same for them. Besides, poor Patty is starving to death."
"They're on rations. Any food hoarding, by getting something additional, they lose their cards. According to the law, we can eat him, but they can't. I'm supposed to turn him into the communal food supply."
"Damn it, John. You are so cold-blooded logical in some ways, and an idiot in other ways. Take him down to the Robinsons now. They can trade us something for him later."
John finally nodded. She handed Zack's body to him. "I'll get Lee to help with the bodies. You keep the girls out of the living room and kitchen."
"You'll tell them?"
John asked. She nodded. John slowly walked over to the car.
"Don't move another goddamn inch," a voice hissed in the darkness.
He froze, cursing himself as an idiot. There had been a third man, maybe a fourth or fifth. John prepared to drop Zack, shout a warning before they got him, give Jen and Elizabeth time to be ready.
"John? That you?"
And now he recognized the voice. It was Lee Robinson.
"Jesus, Lee, yeah, it's me. I heard shots. Came up to help."
"Thanks, Lee." He stepped out of the shadows and drew closer.
"John, what are you carrying?" "Oh, Jesus, not one of the dogs."
"Zack, if he and Ginger hadn't have warned us, they'd have had us, two of them. I killed both. Zack got shot by one of the bastards."
"I just heard a shot a minute ago."
"I couldn't do it," John admitted, and he found himself clutching Zack tighter.
What a piece of shit. Jen had to do it. It's okay, John. It's okay. And Lee's arm was around John's shoulder. Southerners, he thought. Southerners and their dogs. They understand. He could feel Lee shaking a bit. He had been partial to Zack as well, their old dog Max, a buddy. Max had disappeared a week ago, most likely poached while wandering in the woods, and Lee was absolutely distraught over him. John gained control, and the two stood there looking at Zack, and each knew what the other was thinking. "Take him, Lee," was all John could say. "John, not in a million years did I ever think we'd come to this." John handed the body over. "I'll take him down to Mona. She'll be respectful as she..." He started to choke up as well, and couldn't speak for a moment. "Thank you. I was getting frantic over Patty. The damn rations just aren't enough. John, Zack saved her life, too." John started his drive down to town several hours later. The bodies of the two robbers stretched out on the porch as he pulled away from the house. Bartlett's meat wagon, as they now sardonically called it, the old VW bus, could be sent up later to get them. John felt so cold about their deaths that for a moment he dwelled on the thought that two extra rations would now be spent, the reward for the digging of a grave in the golf course cemetery. There were 1,500 graves there now, another 500 filling the Swannanoa Christian School's soccer field. Keller had been right. The dying time was now upon them. Deaths from starvation were soaring. Yesterday there had been close to 100, mostly the elderly still, and then parents. As a historian, John knew that was the pattern, though a casual observer, an academic sitting in an armchair calculating such things, would have figured the children next. But what parent would eat while their child starved? The ration lines, now 5 of them scattered around the two communities, had nearly 90% of the surviving population showing up for one distribution a day of soup and either a biscuit or a piece of bread. That was another state secret. The bakery, closely guarded at a local pizza shop where wood heat had been rigged in, was now mixing in sawdust to give the bread bulk, to fill stomachs. It was the same as Leningrad, and actually that had been the inspiration for John to suggest it. So the parents, many of them working to get an extra ration, were bringing the food home to their children, then dying off. And once both parents were gone, it was hoped that neighbors or kin would take the orphans in. Charlie and Tom had been forced to issue strict orders that personnel receiving extra rations were to eat them on site when the rations were issued, but even so, they'd stash a biscuit in a pocket. Some even rigged up plastic liners in their pockets to pour the soup into when they thought no one was watching, then slowly walked home where 2, 3, 4 hungry kids might be waiting. And yet, ironically, at the same time, at least according to Voice of America, there were signs that some recovery was going on, down along the coast. The federal government was reconvened, functioning aboard the carrier Abraham Lincoln, and martial law was still in effect. There were reports that the corn and wheat harvest of the Midwest would be brought in, and train lines reopened to move the bulk goods. Headquarters for the Southeast Emergency Government had been established in Charleston, and daily reports now issued about the progress of rebuilding, even a claim that a nuclear power plant in Georgia had been brought back online. But it seemed like any progress being made was moving along the coast or slowly edging towards Atlanta. He wondered if someone up the command chain had decided to triage off Upper South Carolina and Western North Carolina. There had been overflights, though. Fighters, several times. A C-17 transport, and Asheville finally admitted that replacement parts for generators for the hospital had been airlifted in. Asheville was playing its cards close. The phone line that Black Mountain had started had been run into the county office in Asheville, but the communications were rather one-sided,
as if the director there resented the showdown over refugees versus water supply. The thought that some kind of medical supplies had been lifted into Asheville had made John wild, Washington having to nearly physically restrain him from driving straight there and demanding some fresh insulin. He had personally telephoned Burns, who still was running Asheville, and begged for any information on insulin, and Burns flatly announced none had come in, and even if it had, he would not release any outside of the town no matter what. Insulin. John was obsessed with it. 2 days ago, Jennifer's blood sugar was up. She had taken an injection, and it was still up. He had finally gone for Michaela, and she carefully examined Jennifer, then took him aside.
"The 3 remaining bottles, they might have spoiled," was all Michaela would say.
It had finally taken 3 times the normal dose to bring Jennifer's level back down. Her time had been cut by 2/3. And help, if it was indeed help, was still as far away as the far side of the moon. Of the other diabetics in the town, over half were dead, the others dropping off fast. He turned off the motor of his car, sat back, and lit another cigarette, the 6th of the day. Ah, the hell with it, and the counting out. He sat there, smoked, looking at the interstate. Cars still stalled where they had died over 2 months ago. "Somehow we've all been playing a game of reality avoidance with ourselves, even on day one," he realized. Anyone with even the remotest understanding of EMP and the threat to the nation should have been going insane before it hit. During World War II, the entire nation had been mobilized. All the talk of loose lips sinking ships, the scrap drives, the guards on railroad bridges in Iowa. Much of it was absurd when the threat was finally understood long after the war was over. There were no legions of spies and saboteurs in America, and the few who were in place or attempted to infiltrate were caught within days by the FBI. There was a threat. And though remote, it was at least acted on back then. But this time, the threat was 100 times worse, and they did nothing, absolutely nothing. Angrily, he stubbed out the cigarette and lit another. If everyone had been educated to it the same way civil defense had once been in the curriculum of every school back in the 1940s and 1950s, if people knew the simple things to do on day one— Charlie already trained to react to an EMP, mobilize his forces, and react quickly. If they had but a few simple provisions stocked away, the same way anyone who lives in hurricane or tornado country does, would they be in this mess? The crime, the real crime, was those who truly knew the level of threat doing nothing to prepare or prevent it. Bitterly, he wondered if they were suffering as the rest of the nation now suffered, or were they safely hidden away, the special bunkers for Congress, the administration, where food, water, and medicine for years were waiting for them, and their families? The thought of it filled him with rage. He knew what he would do if he could but go there now, show them Jennifer, and then do what he wished he could do to them. And he could see his own avoidance of it all since that first day, even as he did scramble to at least get insulin. Food, bulk food, just a 50-pound bag of rice or flour, shoes, batteries, an additional test kit for Jennifer, damn it, even birth control for Elizabeth, dog food, a water filter so they didn't have to boil what they now pulled out of the swamp green pool. I should have had those on hand. It was over 2 months later, and people in his small North Carolina town were dying of starvation. I pretty well understood it on day one, and yet I avoided the worst of it ever since, he thought. Doc Keller had alluded to it in their meeting of nearly a month ago, when the decision was made to reduce rations for most of the populace, but we did not fully face the horrible realities of it. America, the breadbasket of the world, which could feed 1 billion people without even breaking a sweat, was dying now of starvation. The 2 frequencies of Voice of America were talking daily about the first harvests coming in from the southern Midwest, of cattle being driven,
and it all sounded to him like the old Chinese and Soviet broadcasts of the Cold War, when they boasted daily about their great strides even while people lived in squalor and indeed did die of starvation. The food was there, but it would never get here, not to this place, not now. That meant that over 20% of the town was dead, and upwards of half would die in another 30 days, while food by the millions of tons rotted, because they still had no means of moving it in bulk to where it was needed most. The medicines. Yes, they were out there, someplace. Some stockpiles overseas, perhaps. But the factories that made them were in cities, and the cities had no power, or perhaps a few places here and there, and the people who worked in the factories were hunkered down or scattered refugees, perhaps some of the very people now lying dead below the barrier. And even if the factory did suddenly turn on, the insulin was processed from genetically altered bacteria in labs, but the labs, maybe in New York or Arizona, were 1,000 miles away. The bottles it was then loaded into? Perhaps made in Mexico, and trucked to the lab 1,000 miles away, and then loaded back aboard climate-controlled trucks and taken to airports and priority shipped in containers specially designed, those containers perhaps made in Mississippi. And so it went. IV bags. Nearly all the IV bags in America were made in just a few places. Million a day, and they were boxed in sterile environments and then shipped to other factories that filled them with blood drawn perhaps 1,000 miles away, or various solutions mixed in Oregon and shipped to Texas, there to meet the bags to be filled. And so much from overseas, that were in container ships offloaded by diesel-electric-powered cranes, then loaded into trucks. Perhaps the plastic to make the IV bag first emerging from the ground as oil in Kuwait, and from there to Texas, to be cracked, and the appropriate chemicals siphoned off and shipped to Louisiana, to be turned into plastics, some of them for plastic bags to come to Asheville. Such a vast, intricate, beautiful, profoundly complex web, the most complex in history, and all along a few enemies— enemies whom Americans had for years ignored, and then in one day had come to hate. And that hate had slowly changed, as it does with Americans, to remoteness, disdain, and a smug sense of ultimate victory, perhaps even victory by the simple fact that they made a wish that the enemies were no longer there. For ultimately, what did 9/11 do in the coldest sense? It killed 3,000. Did the economy collapse the next day? Did John's Jennifer miss an insulin shot? Did the workers in a factory that made insulin scatter in panic on 9/11? No. And in spite of outrage, people's tears of empathy, unless it was a friend or one of their own blood lost that day, their world really did not change, other than the annoyance of getting through an airport. The web of our society, John thought, was like the beautiful spider webs he'd find as a boy in the back lot after dawn on summer days, dew making them visible. Vast, beautiful, intricate things. And at the single touch of a match, the web just collapsed, and all that was left for the spider to do, if it survived that day, was to rebuild the web entirely from scratch. And our enemies knew that, and planned for it. And succeeded. He tossed the second butt out the window, lit another, and drove into town to report the attack on his house and get Jim to bring up the meat wagon. The soup line at the elementary school was already forming up, even though distribution of the day's rations wasn't until noon. The carcass of a hog was trussed up to a tree, actually barely a suckling, already stripped down to the bones, which would be tossed into the pot as well. The people online were skeletal, their weight really falling away now. Many could barely shuffle along. Kids were beginning to have bloated stomachs. Out along the curb, half a dozen bodies lay, dragged out for the meat wagon, no longer even given the dignity of a sheet to cover them. A man, three kids, Most likely their parents dead and no one to truly care for them, and a woman, obviously a suicide, with her wrists slashed open. It made John think of the woman on the road. Carol, that was her name. Most likely dead by suicide long ago. The refugee center was starting to empty out, people beginning to move into the homes of locals who had died. In the short drive, he could sense the collapse setting in. The bodies in front of the elementary school, the fact of just how dusty and litter-strewn the streets were. Without the usual maintenance, storm drains had plugged up with debris. Several trees had dropped, and were then cut back just enough to let a single vehicle through. One of the beautiful towering pines in front of the elementary school had collapsed across the road, smashing in the front porch diner across the street. Enough of the tree had been cut away to clear the road for traffic, the rest just left in place. Nothing had been done to repair the diner's crushed roof. The inside now left open to the elements, the building itself broken into repeatedly by scavengers who were now willing to scrape the grease out of the traps as food. That broke his heart every time he drove past it. The diner had been his usual stop on many a morning long ago. Mary would have freaked on his breakfast of bacon, eggs, and hash browns, but he so loved the place, the owner a man he truly respected, hard-working, starting from a hole in the wall a block away to create a diner that was the place in Black Mountain for breakfast. Truckers, construction workers, shop owners, and at least one professor type. How many mornings had John spent there, after dropping the kids off at school, for a great meal, a cigarette, the usual banter, playing one of the games the owner carved out of wood, trick puzzles, and then going on to his late morning lecture. What a world we once had, he sighed. The parking lot of the bank at the next corner was becoming weed-choked, though that was being held back a bit by children from the refugee center plucking out any dandelions they saw and eating them. The bank had been one of the last of an old but dead breed, locally owned, the owner's Land Rover still parked out front, covered in dust and dried mud. John turned past Hamid's store. A few cars out front, a VW Bug and a rust bucket of a 65 Chevy, a couple of mopeds. Hamid had traded some smokes for an old generator, traded some cigarettes to someone else to get it fixed, and now he actually had some juice. It had been quite the thing when he fired it up and the lights flickered on dimly. He had diverted the juice into two things, a fridge and one of the pumps for his gas tanks. John had instantly thought of asking Hamid to take the vials of insulin he still had, but Michaela had vetoed it. The generator-driven power was variable, shutting down, fired back up again. Better to keep it at a steady 55 than at 40 degrees that might suddenly climb to 60 or 70 before plunging back down below freezing. But still, his old friend had come through for him, a debt he could never repay, and he felt like a beggar every time he wandered in.
"For my favorite little girl,"
Hamid would say as he pressed a small package into John's hands, a piece of newspaper with a pound or two of ice inside. Ice, a precious pound or two of ice to try to keep the temperature of the remaining vials down a few degrees. "I still owe you $20, John would always say, and Hamid would just smile, for he had little girls too, and he knew, and he was proud to be an American helping a friend. Michaela. Funny, John hadn't thought of her these last few days. My own starvation, he thought. The unessentials of the body shut down first, and after 4 years of celibacy after the death of Mary, he had grown used to it. He knew Michaela was interested in him. In a vastly different world, they would definitely have been dating, but not now. Besides, he did not want to upset the delicate balance of his family. Jen had been Mary's mother. How would she react? The girls? They might like Michaela as a friend, but as something more? For Jennifer, her mom was already becoming remote. But for Elizabeth, The death had hit at 12, a most vulnerable of times, and her room still had half a dozen pictures of the two of them together, and one that still touched John's heart, a beautifully framed portrait from Mary's high school graduation, the color fading, but Mary very much the girl he had met in college. He pulled up to the town hall complex. The rumble of a generator outside varied up and down in pitch as more power or less was being used. One of the fire trucks was being washed down. The mechanics had finally bypassed all the electronics, done some retrofitting, and the engine had finally kicked back to life 10 days ago. He walked in. Charlie was in his office, caught in the corner unmade, looking up as John came in. Charlie had lost 30 pounds or more, face pinched. He had a cup of what looked to be some herbal tea. 2 dead up in my house, shot them this morning, John said matter-of-factly.
That's 8 reported now just this morning,
Charlie replied, his voice hoarse. John sat down, looked at his pack of cigarettes, 14 left, and offered one to Charlie, who did not hesitate to take it. Damn it, Charlie. You gotta get at least one extra meal in you. He shook his head.
Might not matter soon, anyhow.
Why's that?
We think the posse is coming this way.
What?
Don Barber flew his recon plane out a couple hours ago to take a look for us along Interstate 40 heading towards Hickory. He's yet to get back. 4 days ago, we didn't have a single refugee at the barrier. 2 days ago, nearly 100. Yesterday, more than 200. It's as if something is pressuring them from behind. Rumors running with them that Morganton was just looted clean. A damn medieval pillage. Also, we had a shooting last night on the interstate.
So that's becoming almost a daily routine, John said coolly. This one was different. One of the few heading east, big guy, looked fairly well fed.
So what did he do?
Washington spotted him. He just had a gut feeling because he had seen this same guy the day before heading west. He stood out because he looked so well fed. Washington tagged along with the escort taking this guy and some other refugees east and played dumb. The big guy was peppering him with questions. How many folks lived here? How much food left? Any organized defense?
A spy?
Exactly.
So Washington drew down on him, just before the gap, and almost got killed for it. The guy had what Washington called an old-fashioned pimp gun up the sleeve of his jacket. Small 22. He actually got off the first shot, and then Washington blew him away.
Washington okay?
Nicked on the side. Keller said another inch in, and given the way things are now, he'd have been in deep trouble.
Where is Washington now?
Up at the college?
I think we should go up.
Charlie nodded, and the two got into John's Edsel for the short drive. The drive up to the campus reminded him yet again of the lost world of but several months back, his daily commute of not much more than 4 miles, and he thought again of bacon and eggs.
Damn, that would be good now.
He almost said it to Charlie. Food had indeed become the obsessive topic on people's minds, but now there was a ban on it being spoken of, a major breach of etiquette. It just made everyone crazy to talk about what they would eat when things got better. As they passed the turnoff to the North Fork Road, there were 2 more bodies covered with sheets out in front of a home.
Ah, shit, not the Elliots,
Charlie sighed. 3 children were out on the lawn, all of them skinny as rails except that their stomachs were bloating, a neighbor clinging to them. That had started to appear over the last couple of weeks, kids with stomachs bloating out even as they starved. Keller told John it was edema, fluid buildup as their bodies inside began to shut down. It was the type of images he would always turn off when an infomercial ran for some Save the Kids-type charity. Always it was kids in Africa or some disaster-stricken area in Asia with the bloated stomachs.
He wondered if now, at this very moment, in a place in the world where electricity still flowed, such images were on their screens. Give now to save the starving children in America. God, it was a sobering thought. Would our friends overseas, those we had helped so many times, without a thought of any return, now be coming to us? Were ships loaded with food racing towards us? Or was there silence, or worse, laughter and contempt? He was getting an extra ration as a gravedigger, in fact two rations because he was digging two a day, Charlie said, interrupting John's thoughts. And taking them home to the kids and his wife, John said quietly. They didn't even slow down, but just drove on. They passed three boys, early teens, two of them toting 22s, the other a pellet gun, and the youngest with, yes, a bloated stomach as well. All three moving stealthily, peering up at the trees, the interlacing telephone and power lines. There was most likely barely a squirrel or rabbit left in town now, and birds were now becoming part of the pot. John's own hunts had started to come up empty unless he went deeper and deeper into the Piscoff forest. It knotted him up, thinking about it. Zack had not even died with a meal in his stomach. He had come close to fighting with his Ginger for the rabbit he had bagged yesterday. Ginger was only allowed the bones after Jen had scraped off every bit of flesh for a rabbit stew. "You know, we're actually starting to run short of small-caliber ammunition," Charlie said as they drove past the boys. "Most folks who had a 22 in the closet rarely dragged it out and at best maybe had a box of 50 to 100 rounds. Understand trading now is 5 bullets for a squirrel or rabbit." Fortunately, John still had several hundred himself, but he was short on shotgun shells. The heavier caliber stuff, he had kept that for other reasons. The gate ahead was roadblocked. In the past, the students guarding it recognized his car and waved it through. Not today. They forced him to a stop, one of them standing back with a 12-gauge leveled, while the other came around the side and looked in. "Good morning, sir. Are you okay?" "It's Rebecca, isn't it?"
"Yes, sir."
She looked in his back seat, nodded, and two students started up the Volkswagen blocking the gate, let it roll forward for him to pass, then backed it into place and shut it down.
"Kids are getting more cautious."
"Well, with all the dead last night in break-ins," John said. "Lord knows how many others will find out today we're successful and the families inside the homes are not dead and rotting. I think it's safe to assume that some of this posse crowd have already infiltrated in, looked us over, and decided we are worth taking, at the very least to then move on to Asheville. Perhaps some are even holed up in some houses, watching, if we are getting prepared." They turned into the drive, heading up to Gaither Hall. And the troops were out. The days of close-order drill long past, they were practicing covering fire and withdrawing in front of the library, Washington pacing back and forth, yelling instructions as John pulled up and turned off the car. Washington turned and went through the ritual, still the annoying ritual for John, of saluting, which he returned. Kids were all around, hunkered down low, concealed behind trees, under vehicles, up in windows of buildings. Farther up the road, John could see what must be the Red Force, Company B, deployed out beyond the girls' dorm, a dozen vehicles running, some Volkswagens, again courtesy of Jimmy Bartlett, a few farm pickup trucks. One had a fake machine gun mounted on the back. Technicals, John thought they were called in Somalia. Washington held up his megaphone.
"Captain Malady, now!"
Kevin Malady had been, of all things, an assistant librarian. With his strong, massive shoulders, thick black hair, and lantern jaw that made him look a bit like Schwarzenegger, the kids quickly giving him the nickname Conan the Librarian. He was ex-military, a sergeant with a mech unit in Iraq back in 03. He had just resigned from the library staff and had planned to go to Princeton Theological in the fall.
Now he was the CO of Company B. He knew his stuff as they simulated the assault. The technical, supposedly laying down fire support, a vehicle with a plow bolted to the front, driving straight at the barrier. Of course it came to a stop, Washington shouting that the barrier had been pierced. Melody had more of his troops storm from around abandoned cars, rushing the barrier. If this had been done a few months ago, the kids would have been laughing, seeing it as play-acting, shouting and whooping. Not now. They were silent, following directions from their officers, several of them staff and faculty with military experience, the defensive force pulling back to try to lure the attackers into what would be the killing zone if the gap was pierced on the interstate. A couple of hundred yards back from the gap, the road was flanked on one side by a high concrete wall, a sound barrier erected for several hundred yards to shield the conference center. Washington had already established firing positions on the reverse side of the wall. The campus chapel, the new one built several years back, which now housed a famous fresco, The Return of the Prodigal, by the famous artist Ben Long, was serving as a simulator for the wall, students suddenly popping up from behind the ridge of the roof.
"That's it," Washington shouted. "Once up, it's fire superiority. Pour it down fast and hard, fast and hard. Panic them."
The simulation was starting to break down, kids standing around. There could be no realism to it, no blanks, no Miles laser packs. They had used paintballs at the start, but the supply of those was used up in 2 days. Washington blew his whistle.
"Stand down. That's it. Take an all break. Dinner at noon."
To John's amazement, a fifer started to play, and it sent a chill down his back. It was the D'Incenzo boy, not a student at the college, a local kid who had belonged to the reenactment unit and had taken to hanging around the college. Washington had taken a liking to him, and he was now the official fifer for the militia, playing Yankee Doodle as the exercise ended.
"Good marching stuff,"
Washington said as John looked back at the kid, wearing a Union capy.
"The students love it, and it's good for morale."
Students came out from buildings, crawled out from under concealment, all of them armed. Their equipment had been gradually upgraded. Most were armed with semi-autos, heavier caliber, a great percentage of Company B with deer rifles, a lot with scopes. Charlie had already said that if a crisis came, he'd release the automatic weapons kept in the police station to Washington. A few civilians had come forward as well, one showing up with what had been an illegal full-auto M16 with over 400 rounds, saying as long as he could tote it in a fight, he'd be part of the militia, a vet from the early days in Nam. Both companies were now rounded out by vets who had seen service as far back as Korea, adding nearly 100 to their ranks. These vets might be old, but they had combat experience and were now slotted in as squad and platoon leaders. Others, the survivalist types, including the legendary Franklins, were teaching the kids how to concoct homemade claymores, landmines, satchel charges, and homemade rocket launchers fashioned out of PVC pipe. The reenactors in the town regretted they could not get their hands on an original cannon, but were now mixing up black powder for these weapons and rigging up a field piece made out of steel pipe that would be packed with canister. As for the students, within seconds they were reverting back, a couple of the guys laughing, shouting good-natured insults. More than a dozen couples instantly paired up, a few of them, without any attempt at stealth, with arms around each other, heading down towards the woods behind the science building.
"There's a major problem brewing, and figured we should check in with you," Charlie said, his voice thin, raspy.
Washington nodded, and the three took the shaded path, walking over the old stone arch bridge that led from Gregor Dorm to Gaither. John had always loved this place in particular. On many a day he'd sit on the bridge to watch the creek tumble beneath him. Students were always passing by, and it was a great place to just hang out, chat with kids, sneak a smoke with another smoker. A breaking of the rules, since they were outside a designated spot, but the dean had given up a long time ago trying to hassle John about it, and the president actually thought it was good, a faculty member twisting the administrative tail a little with the kids joining in. They headed into President Hunt's office. He rarely showed at the campus now, though his home was but a quarter mile away. In spite of the pleadings of John, Reverend Abel, and Washington, President Hunt had made a solemn statement that he and his wife would refuse extra rations. Every ounce of food had to go to our soldiers and volunteers. It was typical of him, incredibly noble, and as a result, he was dying. They walked in and sat down around the conference table in the office, and as they did so, a humming sputter echoed, and they were back up, looking out the windows. It was Don, in his Aronca L-3, D-Day invasion stripes starkly visible on the wings and fuselage, clearing the crest by Lookout Mountain, and then dipping down into the narrow valley of the cove. He circled the campus once, tight turn, not 50 feet above the trees, saluted, and then leveled out to head south into town and the landing strip at the Ingram Shopping Plaza.
"So, let me guess. The posse is coming," Washington said. John and Charlie nodded in agreement. It was inevitable. Sooner or later they'd hear about us and figure we had something worth taking. "He went out when? About 2 hours ago?" Washington asked.
"Make it 2 and a half," John said. "That plane cruises at about 60. It ain't good news. They must be getting close." They went back to the table and sat down.
"One of the boys bagged a bear last night," Washington said. "It's down in the cookhouse now. Meat for everyone at noon, maybe a pound apiece."
John instantly felt his mouth water. Twice now they had bagged bears, and though greasy as hell, bear was filling.
"I just wish we could get President Hunt to join us. I sent a couple of the girls up there to plead with him, and they said he just smiled and refused. They were crying when they came back, said he looks terrible."
"That's Dan," John said quietly. "And maybe he's right. These kids have to be in good shape. We can't have them staggering like weak kittens if this posse shows up."
"Are they ready?"
Charlie asked. Washington shook his head.
"Not very reassuring, damn it,"
Charlie replied sharply.
"Look, Charlie, I love these kids. I've known them for years. Down deep, they're mostly small-town kids with good hearts, and remember, as a Christian college here, we were drawing kids with particular values and views as well, or at least their parents saw it that way, even if the kids didn't. But if you want the harsh reality, I can pick out a couple of the young men for you, kids who grew up in the projects in Charlotte or Greensboro or Atlanta, and they'll tell you a different story about reality. Kids at 12 capping each other and boasting about being gang bangers. Kids at 16 already with time in jail, maybe fathers already. Cold-eyed as dead snakes, and most of them dead at 25.
"The old sick joke," John sighed. "You won't find a drug dealer with a 401k plan."
"Exactly," Washington snapped. "These kids here, up until 2 months ago, were thinking grades, fooling around, getting married after college. The more mature ones, exactly that. They're 401k plans. What they face, if we face it, will not just be gangbangers from cities. What will have gravitated to this posse will be every low-life scum with a will to do anything to survive. Mix into that the psychos that Doc Keller was talking about. What happened to guys in prisons when this hit? Where are they now? Remember, our proud country had more people in prison per populace than damn near anywhere else in the world. Let them starve? Execute all of them? Maybe in some of the maximum security houses the warden might have done just that. The food runs out and he lines them all up and shoots them rather than let them escape. But the minimum places, I bet those people were over the little chain-link fences by the third day. Most of the kids with a stupid-ass drug charge went home, but you already had some bad hombres in those places, and they would gravitate together, and now the world is a paradise, wide open, whatever they want, if they have the balls to take it." Washington shook his head. "The food's run out here in the East.
Washington continued. If we win the Midwest, the Corn Belt, Cattle Belt, I'd be more optimistic. But here, density of population versus on-hand food, it's out. It's gone. And those barbarians, for they are barbarians, know only one thing now. Find food, and gorge, and take, and inflict pain as they never